and do it right or do the topic justice.
You write, in America, after the end of Roe v. Wade, one brave source on the record in the final story will often be the best we can get. And you write, countless abortion stories will never be told at all. It won't be because they're lies. It will be because telling them is too risky, because patients and doctors and staffers and volunteers will face arrest for coming forward. Your final recommendations and advice as the editor of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University.
Okay, so I would definitely, I would ask people to think about what they want to do in their stories, and if the point of journalism is to sort of shine a light on untold stories, you need to be thinking how you're going to be doing that at a time when when the people who are receiving abortions that you're writing about are going to be doing something that's illegal in their states. And so you need to come into it with the thought that a lot of these people are not going to want to talk to you. And you sort of need to think about are not going to want to put their names on the record because they're going to be breaking the law. And you're going to need to think about how to tell their stories in a way that's fair and accurate, and how you can do that at a time when you are now writing about something that's going to be illegal in many states.
And of course, the question is, will journalists be considered aiding and abetting if they give information about how people can get abortion in, for example, neighboring states? Laura Hazard-Owen, we want to thank you for being with us. Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University. You're the editor. We'll link to your piece. I'm Amy Goodman.
On 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
Have you been thinking about furthering your involvement with KBOO? The annual election is coming up in September, and that means the board of directors are recruiting for new members. The nominating committee will hold virtual informational sessions on Wednesday, July 20th at 7 p.m. and Tuesday, July 26th at 5:30 p.m. For more information and to obtain a meeting link, go to kboo.fm/boardinfo. That's kboo.fm/boardinfo.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Interstate Bridge Replacement Plan moves to federal environmental review. Protesters harmed by cops in the 2020 protests in Portland can't file a class action lawsuit, and a new report demonstrates the failure of law enforcement in the Uvalde shooting. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 18th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. The preliminary design of the interstate bridge replacement has been approved by local governments and is moving on to the next phase. Local leaders from both sides of the Columbia River agree that the I-5 bridge needs to be replaced, but express some ambivalence about the design. Vancouver City Council was the last local government organization to approve the design. It now moves to the federally required environmental review process. The design is called the Locally Preferred Alternative. It includes 8 lanes, high-capacity light rail, and biking and walking options. It adds a lane to create a partial interchange with Hayden Island, a residential community located in the middle of the river. This added lane is a point of contention, especially for environmental activists who fear the added lane will add cars to the road. The program administrator, Greg Johnson, says there isn't evidence in this case that an added lane would increase traffic. He also stressed that staying on timeline is important to getting grants to help fund the bridge. President Biden's Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act sets aside $40 billion for these types of projects, and Biden referenced the interstate bridge replacement as an example of what the program is for. The next major step for the design is to secure $1 billion in funding from the Oregon legislature in the 2023 session. A federal judge has decided that protesters harmed by Portland police in the summer protests of 2020 can't file a lawsuit as a class action group. The lawsuit was filed by Don't Shoot Portland over 2 years ago, and it led to Judge Marco Hernandez issuing a temporary restraining order on the use of tear gas and quote-unquote less lethal munitions by the PPB in June 2020. A violation of that restraining order later that year resulted in other changes for the city in order to get out of contempt of court for violating the order. But now Judge Hernandez says the plaintiffs don't have enough commonalities to be considered a class action group. A common example of a class action lawsuit is like those for pharmaceutical fraud, when a company makes and markets a drug that harms a large group of people. Judge Hernandez says protesters gassed and shot with less lethal munitions by the PPB don't fit that bill. Don't Shoot Portland has the option to challenge the ruling if they choose to, or they can move forward with the case as is, just not as a class action suit. In his rejection, Judge Hernandez writes that Don't Shoot Portland documented significant abuses by the Portland Police Bureau in their petition for class action status. This November, Multnomah County voters will decide on a ballot measure that would allow undocumented people to vote in future elections. It's led others across the state to push for enfranchisement, or the right to vote, for all Oregonians, regardless if they're U.S. citizens. Eric Tegedoff has more.
In Multnomah County, voters will decide in November whether the right to vote should extend to people who are not citizens. Some say all of Oregon should consider a similar measure. Joanne Mina, based in Bend, is a statewide community organizer for the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice. She points to Bend City Councilman Anthony Broadman, who has advocated for an amendment to Oregon's Constitution to guarantee the right to vote for everyone, regardless of immigration status. Mina says Oregon has expanded the ability to vote, such as with vote by mail, and says this is needed to make democracy even more fair and equitable in the state.
The next step is to allow all community members, adults, members of Oregon, to be part of the decision-making process, to be engaged civically, to be invested in the direction of where Oregon goes.
There are an estimated 108,000 undocumented immigrants in Oregon, according to the Migration Policy Institute. The effort in Multnomah County could be complicated legally because of its constitutionality. However, if legislators or voters passed a statewide amendment to the Constitution, it would remedy this issue. Mina believes it's important to look at the issues the state faces as interconnected.
So that we are leveraging our collective power and even our privilege from more urban areas like Portland and Bend to rural areas that may not have outspoken leadership.
A handful of cities on the East Coast allow non-citizens to vote in elections. A similar measure in New York City was struck down at the end of June. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Texas lawmakers have released new details on the Uvalde shooting, and the Parkland shooter faces the death penalty in trial. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It's clear that what was shown on the video was the exact opposite of the information that I was given on the day that I went out and explained what happened.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott withdrew comments he'd made at the time of the Uvalde school shooting, saying he had been misled. A report by state lawmakers found systemic failures and egregious poor decision-making by multiple agencies meant hundreds of police waited as much as an hour, while a gunman inside Robb Elementary fired more than 100 rounds. The sentencing trial starts today for the gunman who killed 17 in the 2018 mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Nicholas Cruz, 23, admitted guilt and could face life in prison or the death penalty. Steve Bannon, former advisor to former President Donald Trump, is to go on trial for contempt of Congress today. He's accused of failing to testify about the January 6th insurrection. In Saudi Arabia Saturday, President Joe Biden spoke to the Gulf Cooperation Council about working with allies in the region.
As the world grows more competitive, and the challenges we face more complex, is only becoming clear to me that how closely interwoven America's interests are with the successes of the Middle East.
The president called out China, Russia, and Iran as destabilizing. Separately, Biden says he raised the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. U.S. intelligence says MBS likely ordered the killing. Middle East Institute senior fellow Brian Katula says the White House needs strong relations with the Saudis and the Gulf states.
That address energy security, that address regional security, that address food security at a time when there's a lot of turmoil geopolitically.
White House Energy Security Advisor Amos Hochstein says he expects gas prices in the U.S. to fall to $4 a gallon, which is good given Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine.
This is the fastest decline rate that we've seen against a major increase of oil prices during a war in Europe, where one of the parties in the war is the third largest producer in the world.
It's been more than three decades since the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Disability rights activist Judy Heumann remarked on what the anniversary means for folks living with disabilities and their families.
Our moving forward as a disability community, being granted civil rights like other constituents in the United States, not only was a powerful message here, but a powerful message around the world.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Conservation and Clean Air groups have filed a lawsuit challenging the Biden administration's choice to resume oil and gas leases on public lands. Biden paused those leases when he took office. Oil and gas companies, on the other hand, say more drilling contracts will increase the global supply of oil and gas.
A new lawsuit hopes to reverse the BLM's recent approval of oil and gas lease sales on public lands across 8 western states, including nearly 120,000 acres in Wyoming, in part to protect public health. Melissa Hornbein with the Western Environmental Law Center says regions surrounding federal oil and gas production face dangerous air quality issues due to methane leaks, ground-level ozone, and toxic benzene released through flaring that cause direct harm to human health.
There are higher incidences of things like cancer. There are also much higher rates of things like childhood asthma, developmental impacts, maternal and fetal health impacts.
The lawsuit claims the BLM failed to review the full climate impacts of the leases, including the bite that extracted oil and gas would take out of the remaining global carbon budget, the amount of climate pollution left to burn in order to keep temperatures at safe levels. The oil and gas industry raking in record profits as gas prices skyrocketed in the U.S. and across the world, says the new leases will help bring more supply onto the global market. Some Wyoming lawmakers welcome the leases to boost state revenue and add jobs. Hornbein says oil and gas companies are already sitting on thousands of inactive leases and argues there are other uses of public lands that can fill tax coffers and create good-paying jobs.
And it's really going to take a concerted effort to transition away from fossil fuels, but we're being fed this line that we can't survive without this. And the reality is we can't survive with them for the long term.
The world's top scientists recently warned that climate pollution must peak and then begin to go down within 3 years to avoid the most catastrophic impacts of a warming planet. Hornbein says it's going to take a whole of government response to reduce fossil fuels, but also to speed up clean energy production.
When these lands are locked up under federal oil and gas leases, which last 10 years and don't allow for other types of development, that is actively precluding the advancement towards use of federal public lands for renewable energy production.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
A new mural in Eugene depicts Kalapuya people harvesting and preparing native plants from the Willamette Wetlands. Those plants can still be found today at Westmoreland Park, where the mural can be viewed. Lily Bolke has more.
A new mural in Eugene depicts Kalapuya people harvesting native plants and preparing them as food and medicine. It's part of a larger project to provide information and a guide to native plants and their uses in the Willamette Wetlands. Mural artist Susan Applegate says the panels on the mural are meant to reflect what's known as the seasonal round, a pattern of moving to different locations for food harvesting at different times of year. She adds, it's important to note the plants depicted are also right there in Westmoreland Park.
There in the park, you have access to the immediacy of living species. That was exciting, as well as the idea of working with what has gone on before, and how do we clue into the past to take care of the present? With that in mind.
Applegate worked with Esther Stutzman, a Kalapuya elder and storyteller, on the mural, which is 64 feet long and 9 feet high. It's located on the east wall of the Dr. Edwin Coleman Jr. Community Center, which sits between two wetland areas. Jennifer Isola is with the group Beyond Toxics, one of the project's sponsors. She knows a nonprofit started by Esther Stutzman and her family, the Komama Cultural Preservation Association, has published a set of Kalapuya dictionaries. The mural project incorporates Kalapuya words for native plants as well as their English names.
There are several of the native plants that grow in the wetlands that are identified in the Santiam dialect of the Kalapuya language. So there is a language revitalization component to this project. There is the cultural components, and really just sharing all of that with the community in such a beautiful way.
She adds the project was created in collaboration with the Friendly Area Neighbors Equity Action Team, Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, Kalapuya Descendants, City of Eugene Human Rights and Neighborhood Involvement, and City of Eugene Parks and Open Space. This is Lily Bolke.
A spike in fertilizer prices has put the industry that makes fertilizer at odds with farmer advocates. Mike Mullen has the story in Iowa.
Fertilizer prices keep rising, hurting farmers in Iowa and around the country. The industry is pushing for policy changes it thinks could help the situation, but advocates for producers feel those ideas avoid core issues. Analysts say the price shift began last fall with supply chain issues cited as one factor. In response, the Fertilizer Institute suggests eliminating export restrictions in China, dropping vaccine mandates at the Canada-U.S. border for truck drivers, and encouraging growers to adopt stewardship practices. Joe Maxwell of the group Farm Action agrees that global matters are a barrier, but he feels the recently released recommendations gloss over a key area.
The document is one as if there is a long-term supply-demand failure and ignores that the issue we've been having with fertilizer is as much an issue of concentration and price gouging as it is supply disruption.
Research arms such as the Bureau of Economics say four corporations control 75% of nitrogen fertilizer production in North America. But the industry argues the U.S. market still is competitive and that many other countries only have a single domestic fertilizer producer. The USDA is moving forward on a series of plans to address competition concerns. Jesse Womack of the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition says some of those efforts should focus on helping farmers find alternatives to synthetic fertilizers.
Not just creating additional domestic production of fertilizers, but
truly reducing farmer dependence on fertilizer.
But the Fertilizer Institute's Corey Rosenbusch is among those not as convinced that dependency can be reduced.
Without fertilizer, you can erase 50% of the crop yields, and we've been talking about massive starvation. And food security now is front and center, and we realize that the foundation of long-term food security is access to fertilizer.
Mike Moen, Iowa News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our in-depth report on Dinolandia, a sprawling two-story dinosaur museum in downtown Portland. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 61. Tomorrow, sunny skies continue with a daytime high of 90 degrees. Today in history, in 1918, the first president of South Africa and Nobel Prize laureate Nelson Mandela was born. He was the first black head of state in South Africa and their first democratically elected leader. His government focused on dismantling the legacy of apartheid. Mandela's birthday is celebrated as an international holiday created by the UN in 2009. The quote of the day is from Mandela, who said, quote, "What counts in life is not the mere fact that we have lived. It's what difference we have made to the lives of others." At the World Athletics Championship in Eugene this weekend, one Oregon sprinter got some unfortunate and perhaps ironic news. He was disqualified for being too fast. Sprinter Devin Allen expected to be racing for a medal in the 110-meter men's hurdles event, but was disqualified for a false start. A false start is a disqualifying start in racing sports because it means the racer has started before the official signal has been given. Allen reacted to the starting gun faster than is allowed in the race. His reaction measured at 0.099 seconds. That's 1/1000th of a second too fast to be allowed. Allen pleaded his case, but to no avail. U.S. sprinter Grant Holloway won the event, taking home his second consecutive World Championships gold medal. A coding camp for Native girls kicks off this week, aiming to boost students into STEM. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A 10-week virtual coding camp for Native girls recently started to get more girls interested in STEM. In 2020, only 0.1% of engineers and scientists were Native women. Taylor Stagner reports.
The Sisterhood of Native American Coders is in its third year. The group puts together a coding camp for girls 9 to 12 and has participants from 89 different tribes. The group aims to expose young Native students to coding principles. Founder Elizabeth Holm attends Stanford studying computer science. She says the group brings together coding mentors from across the U.S.
Our goal is really to get them interested at that young age by exposing it to them, showing them how much fun it can be and like how creative they can be with it, and hopefully inspiring them to continue onward with STEM.
Holmes said that the program was originally in person, but due to the pandemic, moved online, which allowed the group to include more girls. For National Native News, I'm Taylor Stagner.
Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez signed legislation into law on Friday, which provides more than $1 billion for infrastructure projects on the reservation. Federal funds from the American Rescue Plan invest in water projects, electricity, broadband, housing, COVID-19 mitigation, public safety, and local community priorities. A ceremony was held in New Mexico and streamed online. President Nez says jobs are being created.
We have our Navajo people living off the Navajo Nation, your children, your grandchildren, that are building skyscrapers, right? They're building big old stadiums. They're building homes for other people because they have to work out there. But ladies and gentlemen, when we sign this bill, it is time to open back the door to the Navajo Nation and welcome our Navajo professionals and our young people home, right?
The signing represents the largest ever investment in infrastructure projects for the Navajo Nation. The legislation was approved by the Tribal Council by a 20-2 vote during a special session in June. In 2020, the tribe implemented more than $700 million in federal CARES Act funds, which invested in similar infrastructure projects. Chandeska Chickenaw Community College in North Dakota is celebrating the release of the book Miniwakan, which is described as a language tribute to the Spirit Lake Tribe's traditional language and oral history. Tribal College President Cindy Lindquist says the book will be part of curriculum and hopes to engage surrounding communities.
Trying to help non-natives understand indigenous people and our respective cultures and languages. And then as you get into understanding, there is such richness, there's such commonality among the values.
It's the third such book the school has issued, and leaders say it coincides with similar projects carried out by tribal colleges and universities across the country. On Thursday, signed copies will be given away during a public event. Native American Basketball Invitational Championship games will be streamed on ESPN Plus. The games kicked off Sunday in Phoenix, Arizona. More than 400 games will be played this week in Phoenix area gyms. There are more than 130 teams comprised of male and female athletes ages 14 to 19. The games will be available to watch on ESPN Plus Friday and Saturday. Organizers say this will mark the first time an all-Native youth sporting event will be featured on a major sports network. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new report says that the pandemic has had an outsized effect on women, their families, and their personal finances. It says for Black women and Latinas in particular, their student loan debt remains at staggering levels. These groups typically have higher student loan balances than their white counterparts. Danielle Smith has more with the author of the report.
COVID-19 has touched just about every facet of life, and a new report from the Center for Responsible Lending says women repaying student loans have been hit especially hard. The report says, in particular, the pandemic exacerbated the financial instability of women of color, reducing their ability to repay their student loan debt. Report co-author Sunny Glockman says, in part, it's a racial equity issue. And even the temporary pause in student loan repayments hasn't been enough to help many women catch up.
One of the biggest things that happened was folks were losing their jobs. And whether it was they were losing their jobs because they were furloughed, because their company was struggling to keep its doors open, whether it was because they were working in a high contact job and, you know, had someone at home who was immunocompromised.
The report also says Black and Latina women have shown immense resiliency in tough financial times, but it found most don't feel prepared to resume their loan payments without some difficulty. The federal pause on student loan repayments ends August 31st. The report recommends an across-the-board student debt cancellation of $50,000 per borrower. In the meantime, Glockman says putting these payments on hold has absolutely helped women of color.
Having one less bill to pay, your student loan monthly payment, that was a huge help. I think what our research was looking at is whether these women, Black women, are going to be better prepared to resume making payments, which I think is an argument that is not necessarily true.
The report also says what is known as the income-driven repayment, or IDR plan, may not be a good option for some women. The IDR promises cancellation of student debt after 20 or 25 years of repayment, but fewer than 200 people have had their loans forgiven. Glockman says there may be a way to improve the program.
So we actually, one of our recommendations is to apply IDR retroactively. So implement a retroactive income driven repayment waiver. What that would do is say, if you've been doing the right thing in years past, you should be able to qualify for income driven repayment.
She adds women carry about 2/3 of the $1.7 trillion federal student debt, and Black women are more than twice as likely as white men to owe more than $50,000 in undergraduate debt. I'm Danielle Smith, Keystone State News Connection.
3/4 of Montana farmers and ranchers in a recent survey say they're anxious about climate change and how it could impact their business. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Farming can be a stressful profession. and it's getting more so as climate change brings increasingly severe weather. Drought and extreme heat can damage crops. Heavy rain can flood fields and cause fungal growth. A late cold snap can kill young plants. Paul LaChapelle of Montana State University says that growing risks and uncertainty are taking a toll on farmers and ranchers' mental health. He and co-researchers surveyed about 120 Montana farmers and ranchers.
Nearly three-quarters noted they were experiencing moderate to high levels of anxiety when thinking about climate change and its effects on their agricultural business.
So he says it's important to ensure that farmers in remote areas have easy access to mental health services, for example, with telehealth appointments. And he says they may need resources, training, and financial support to adapt their farming practices as the climate warms. LaChapelle says the research should sound an alarm about the well-being of those who work to provide food for the country.
It's absolutely critical that we pay attention to these, what I would say are warning signs, and we need to think about how we can better serve this critical part of our society and economy.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 18th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, Mike Mullen, Danielle Smith, Lily Bolke, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We're taking a look at Dinolandia.